Meow meow, it's me.
Meow meow, also me. What are we doing?
I think I'm thinking about that for the rest of my damn life.
This is living rent free in your brain, isn't it?
Meow meow, it's me.
Meow meow, it's me.
Did I miss a thing?
No. Nope.
Meow meow, it's me.
Meow meow, it's me.
It's in the movie.
It's in the picture we watched.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Meow meow, meow it's me. Yes. No, yes.
Maybe the coolest image, just very diffuse white light reflected off of
lips.
Of lips and a phone. And
a lot of cool images in this.
God, what a cool movie. I know. I'm tipping my hand entirely. Really, this one's a doozy. I can't believe I've been not watching this movie my whole life.
I know. Well, hello again and welcome again to the Good Trash Genrecast, where we gather on a table, we discuss the films you'll never discuss in Film Today's course. This week's film is part of our David Lynch marathon, so much of what we've done over the last few weeks would perhaps find their way into various film studies courses. However, that's usually what we do, and I am still Dustin.
I'm still Arthur.
I am still Dalton, and I totally lost the thread on you explaining that. That's usually what we do, but anyway, I think the listener kept up.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know.
You just totally pulled my brain out through my ear.
He lynched it.
I might have Mobius stripped right back around, and now I'm going to tell you the rest of it, which is the explanation. This is an analysis show, not a review show, in which we spoil the movies.
That's true.
So if you have not seen Lost Highway from the year of our Lord, 1997, and do not wish to be spoiled on it, you can listen to the first half of our show, which looks like this, a synopsis, spoiler-free, thumbs up, thumbs down reviews, talking about what happens, but not about the plot points that are significant. Then we move on to a little game called Expanding the Syllabus, wherein we might have thematic spoilers, but we will not have any further spoilers as far as what goes on in the movie generally. If we do have any spoilers, they'll be kind of gentle at that point. Then we play music to let you know we've gotten down to business, and that's when you know all spoiler bets are off.
Well, now why is that, Dustin? Why does business mean we got to spoil the movie?
Because in order to do analysis, you must have the text, and therefore we must explain said text. It's just kind of one of them rules. It's the way it is.
I think a lot about what April Wolfe would say on Switchblade Sisters, which is that it's not what happens in a movie, but how it happens. That makes it interesting. And I think there's no truer test case of this than Lost Highway.
Yes.
A movie that I think is improved by kind of having some understanding of where it's going
to
take
you're not ready to watch it until you've watched it.
Kind of Mulholland in that way.
Yeah, very much so. Arthur, do you have a synopsis of this movie?
A saxophonist and his wife are sent disturbing videotapes of themselves in their home, and as the images on the tape get worse, the couple will find their lives completely transformed.
Sure.
Excellent synopsis, yeah, Arthur, yeah. As always.
Thank you.
Yeah, it definitely holds a lot of cards to its vest, and that's probably wise.
I'm telling you, between our January anti-trash marathon, where we watched four movies where basically nothing happens, and these Lynch movies, Arthur is really sort of having to hone his blade of a three-sentence explanation of movies, and it's truly
quite
a master
sharp,
at work.
Very keen.
Do it again.
Yeah.
So, I have seen this movie many times. Neither of you have seen it at all, so you're both
correct.
The virgin viewers. You've already tipped your hands. You're going last, or second to last.
Okay.
Arthur, I want to know, do you like Lost Highway? Why or why not?
Look, this movie's so full of itself. David Lynch is out here. Just absolute. Look, guy, we get it, dude. We get who you are. We get your reputation. You think that by 1997, at least he would be over himself. But here we are on the Lost Highway. And yeah, it rocks, man. It just absolutely it whips, bro.
I never can tell if you're going to go ahead and stick
with it. I love it when you're sneaky like that.
Yeah, man. I mean, this movie looks incredible for 97.
Yeah.
I mean, just absolutely stunning visually. And I mean, just the quality of the film and how it's preserved. Is this shot on film?
Yes.
In 97? Okay. I didn't know because it just has a sheen and a polish to it that's just uncanny.
There's almost something proto-digital about it. I get what you're saying. I'm going to like lenses and cameras.
Mulholland Drive is his last film on film.
Yeah, because Inland Empire is like
digital,
consumer grade, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like prosumer.
Gotcha.
So, I mean, yeah, it looks stunning. There's some really cool images in this. We've already alluded to that up top. But, it's interesting and weird. And I don't know. I keep thinking these movies are going to be different from what we're getting. I don't know. I anticipated something much different, I guess, than what it is. And so it's much more straightforward, I think, than I expected it to be.
Yeah.
So there's that thing. And I think this whole thing with Lynch is I've learned, you know, for some reason, I keep thinking that's going to be much more ambiguous and unable to track and hard to follow. But I mean, it's a very coherent A to B to A plot here.
You hear
that? His movies, they're very classically structured, much following those sorts of blueprints and rules. It's just the sort of images he's showing in the way
images
he shows
themselves are sort of pregnant with the symbolic extra meaning, right? Yeah.
Sure, if you want to be a pretentious a-hole about it.
Okay, fine.
get his ass, honestly.
I know these images are pregnant. They're so pregnant with meaning.
I get what you're saying, though, Arthur. Like, you hear about this movie, and people call it a Mobius strip film, and you're like, what the fuck? What are you talking about? But it is pretty straightforward.
And I don't know. I expected the violence to be ramped up more and the sex to be ramped up more.
Especially after Wild at Heart, right?
Yeah. And so, especially when people talk about it and read about it. And so, I don't know.
They are pumping.
Yeah, but it's not Wild at Heart, man.
No.
And it's, you know, obviously Wild at Heart is like a celebration of young lovers. Love,
yeah.
And this is more insidious.
Yeah.
But no, it's good. It's a fun time. Look, Balthasar Getty is just a good name. I know nothing about this person, but it's a great name.
Arthur, I'm going to blow your mind.
All right.
Do you know John Paul Getty III?
No.
Got his ear cut off. They made a movie about it. They had to delete Kevin Spacey from the movie and replace him with Christopher Plummer.
Oh, yeah.
That's that guy that got kidnapped? That's Balthazar Getty's dad.
What?
Okay. Yeah, he's that Getty. He's from those Gettys, of the oil Gettys.
So many murder crimes surrounding the various cast and crew of this film. Yeah. That's wild.
Robert Blake. Yeah,
there's Robert Blake.
Lou Esposito.
Oh, I don't know about this
the,
one.
The more heavyset police officer was the famous mafia cop. He did a bunch of murders for the mob in New York.
Whoa.
Yeah. So, wild.
Questionable casting aside.
Well, they didn't do it at the set. I mean, nobody knew.
Yeah, Richard Pryor wasn't on fire when they shot, you know.
Marilyn Manson hadn't been coming out as an acute.
Weird to see him show up.
Yeah.
But a movie that knows, like, this is a weird face that we can use for five frames.
More Henry Rollins,
great.
Less Marilyn Manson, and we're much better movie.
Honestly, always a good rule to follow. Less Manson, more Rollins.
That's how I live my life, man.
Yeah, so, I like this movie. I think it's a really fun time. I really would like to watch it again because I was really sleepy when I watched it, but that may have also lent into
that makes it better.
The real qualities quite a bit, so I don't know if I do want to watch it again in a not fugue state of mind. So, we watched Lost Highway. I did the thing. It seemed familiar, and I don't know why. I've never seen it, but something about it just seems, it does feel like a proto Mulholland in many ways, but it's not even that. There's just something about the images that seems
something
familiar.
Very iconic about that dark highway lit by headlights kind of zipping down
that
road.
Some of that sequences in the movie,
film
I don't know.
Noir iconography.
I guess maybe that's what it is.
I know what you mean, though. There is like
David Lynch is reconstructing some sort of deja vu that I've experienced in
Betty
my
Page.
Head.
You've seen Betty Page before.
Frank and Renee's house, or Fred and Renee's house, is like the
Fred
most
Fred and Wilma's house.
It's the most like 90s house you've ever seen, but it also looks like it's pulled so right out of a noir.
That entertainment stand thing.
Yes. It's like it's very late 90s, but it also feels like very noir house. I don't know. It's like a combination of classic and, you know, then modern aesthetics that's really interesting to me.
Yeah.
Dalton, what else did you think about this movie?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I'm in the bag with you. I also am excited for a rewatch on this one. I watch it in two parts. When the film sort of evolves and reveals the second half, I watch maybe 10 more minutes. I was like, okay, this is a good stopping point. We'll come back to this tomorrow, which made for an interesting viewing experience. I really am excited to, at some point, go start to finish on this one because it has this weird hold on you, and both halves have such different energies until they have the same energy, which is sort of interesting about the experience of watching this. Because as Arthur has alluded, if you're listening to this and you don't know, this is a film that is about violence against women. And when you hear that, you're like, it's not as heavy or intense as that, like, large thematic umbrella would lead you to believe. And that's kind of all I knew about this was it was a, sort of about this these obsessive men murdering Patricia Arquette. That's kind of what I was aware of going into this film, was that was the gist of the story. And that's sure, that's what happens in the movie, but it's a lot more than that. And it is as untethered from conventional narrative as an American film you'll watch, I think, which I really appreciate about it. It kind of reminds me of Titane or something like that, where it's just like, who cares what happened and what didn't happen and what's literal? And this is a film. We're not concerned about truth. We're concerned about ideas and images. And I definitely, Arthur, you know, jokingly started his review talking about, you know, the pretension around Lynch. And I think when people talk about Lynchian, this is probably the movie they're thinking of. When people are like, Lynch is weird and hard to follow, it's like this and Eraserhead are sort of the two, I think, most capital L, capital Y Lynchian. Because, I mean, in this marathon alone, we watched Dune and Wild at Heart and Straight Story. And although Wild at Heart has sort of these allusions to Wizard of Oz, and it's got its sort of experimental flourishes here and there.
It's pretty point A to point B.
Very conventional film, exactly. Is it Lynchian in that the performances are kind of specific and dialed up? And yes, I think Wild at Heart, more than those other films I've mentioned, it does have sort of that vibe that people are trying to describe when they talk about the David Lynch films that they like and when they try to say Lynchian. Because people throw that around. And if you get into cinema and you start hearing his name thrown around as an adjective and you haven't seen any of the movies, it's kind of hard to know exactly what people are trying to articulate. Because yes, there's the surrealism, but that's not the only thing. There is sort of a lot of ingredients in the David Lynch soup.
The quirkiness and
There's the quirkiness and especially in this film, the darkness, right? And I think maybe of the Lynch I've seen, and now I've crossed off most of the narrative features. I know he's got tons and tons of shorts, but I've crossed most of the features at this point, at this length of the marathon. And this is the one that, like, is haunting me, is like, really, oh boy, what a movie. I've liked all of them, and I think I prefer Straight Story, because, you know, that's just a warm glass of tea. You know, I love a cold glass
warm
of tea.
Warm glass of tea? What's wrong with you?
Well, I almost said warm
hot
glass
cup of tea.
Hot cup of tea. I almost said warm glass of milk. Tea. And then I was like, everybody says that. That's disgusting. Who wants warm milk?
Dalton over here.
Yeah. My point being, Straight Story is like a balm to the spirit.
Yes.
Right? And this is like you're cutting yourself open with a
scalpel. Rubbing your nose in your own nonsense. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially like Lynch sort of, I don't know, very much thinking about men and women and film and sort of the relationship between men and women and the stories we tell, and the narratives that our culture can't stop repeating. It's a heavy movie. It's an interesting movie. It's a spooky movie.
Mm-hmm.
I really like it. Arthur, by the way, it was shot on Panavision Panaflex cameras, a gold 2 and a platinum. So like a late 80s camera. With mostly
35mm film
and mostly Panavision Primo lenses. Yeah. There are some shots with a Mitchell R35, which I don't know a ton about.
I think it's where some of the video footage is shot with, right?
God, that would make sense. That would make sense. But yeah, the gold 2 came out in 87 and the platinum came out in 86. So they are sort of late in the life of 35mm cameras. So I'm wondering if that's where we're getting that really interesting, I don't know. It's just got a crazy aesthetic. I'm with you, Arthur. I'm interested. And we talked all into on this. We talked about Henry Rollins and Marilyn Manson, and his boy, is it a late 90s cast. Mm-hmm. And it's got Rammstein on the soundtrack and a Marilyn Manson cover of, oh God, what is that song called?
I Put a Spell on You.
Thank you. Very of its time, but in a way that like doesn't hurt it. You would be worried that the 90s-ness of this movie would kind of hamper its timelessness.
It captures kind of a timelessness despite itself, doesn't
exactly.
it?
Yeah. Yeah. It, and, you know, I know we love 90s movies here on this show, but there is something about it. It is one of those, the 90s are the 50s for me. You know, it is one of those that are like, it feels timeless and classic and essential in a way that, you know, when you visit a classic film, like, I know this is a 40s film, but Double Indemnity.
Sure.
It does have that, like, oh, this is an essential noir. Like, sorry, Siskel. Sorry, Ebert. Sorry, boys.
They just don't get it.
You know, I love to be at the movies with Roger and Gene. Don't get me wrong. But sometimes they're wrong as hell. And this is one of the cases where they were so deeply wrong. Dustin, Why are Gene and Roger wrong? Tell me about why this movie kicks ass.
They're wrong because of Angela Bandalamente. They are wrong because of Mary Sweeney. They are wrong because of Gary Busey. They are wrong because of incredible Bill Pullman performance, which we haven't talked much about. We talked about Balthazar Getty just a little bit, but Bill Pullman, I think, is really, really solid in that performance in the movie. They're wrong because they fail to see a movie that has representation of acts that it's trying to criticize. They're wrong because they like to be spoon-fed.
The acts that are represented directly on screen are tame for the most part.
For the most part,
we see the aftermath of terrible things. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what the movie wants us to think about. It doesn't want us to revel in the moment of terrible deeds necessarily. Yeah.
And is it a little complex? Yes. Is it a little bit, you know, do you have a number of people in an audience who will sit down and watch a movie like this and go, what just happened to me? Yes, that will be the result of it. But, you know, Lynch has a quote where he says, mystery is good, confusion is bad. And you're not confused, but you definitely know that you are aware of mysteries that you do not have answers for yet and or may not ever have answers for. And I think that really works about the movie because I think it is a movie that draws you back. It's a movie that you watch and then you want to watch it again. And it's got that built-in rewatchability. And I think it absolutely does great stuff. Richard Pryor's last film, great stuff. Jack Nance's last film, working. Second to last, I guess, because he does a straight story. Last one, we're going to
say what? Last one
we're
for
gonna,
our purposes.
We're going to see him in probably. Well, I don't know. You've got one more to pick, Arthur, before I get a pick. So we'll see, I suppose. But
Arthur says no. So that's a wrap on Jack Nance.
I guess so.
Wow. Yeah, one of Lynch's great collaborators.
Yeah, he dies in 01.
Who is he in Straight Story? I know we talked about this last
week. He's one of the guys. He's a guy at one of the gas stations, isn't he?
Gotcha. Gotcha.
Or is he already gone by Straight Story? Because I had the memory.
No, he's not in Straight Story.
I have a memory of a memory of him at this. So
he could have been in Straight Story and fit in easily.
Yeah,
I know. Maybe he dies before Straight Story.
Yeah, he dies in 96
between these two films. Oh, okay. So while this film's wrapping,
that's before this is in theaters. He passes. Okay, so this is actually
his last film. Okay, I said it right the first time, and then I doubted myself. Oh, that's what happens.
C'est la vie.
Yeah. Anyway, I really, really, just. I love the textures of the movie, I think, more than anything. I like the way Lynch uses light. Mary Sweeney, I think, does a great job editing the film and using just those appropriate juxtapositions in a way to make the movie really sing, especially the use of the sped-up track, the sped-up camera for some of those driving scenes. Really, really excellent. We saw a little bit of that in the Straight Story with the tractor going down the hill, that you see a little bit of that style of editing there.
I want to give you've referenced Badalamenti's great score, and obviously she's one of Lynch's great collaborators, but a little love we got to give to one of Trent Reznor's early works as not doing score but as a soundtrack supervisor. Mm-hmm. Exactly. So sort of early on in his move into Hollywood and working in film. So if you're wondering where all of the 90s industrial and grunge and metal came from, that was Trent helping out sweet Mr. David.
And they collaborate a few more times. There's a great Nine Inch Nails little mini concert, mini song performance in episode 8 of The Twin Peaks Return. That's pretty incredible. Surprisingly early in the episode. Usually they're at the end, but this one's very, very early. For reasons. Watch the show. I can't talk about it right now, I don't think. But anyway, it works. It's stupid good. And a thing that's worth reflecting on. And so, that's why I dig it. So there you go, dear listener. Our general thoughts are pro. We like The Lost Highway. We're going to move on to the next part of our show, which is called Expand the Syllabus. And Dalton is going to tell us what that's all about.
I sure will, Dustin. This is the part of the show we call Expanding the Syllabus. And what we're going to do is make a syllabus. That's it. That's the premise of this part of the show and kind of the premise of our show at large. We talk about the films you wouldn't discuss in a film studies course, and we try to do it in a film studies type way. And to segue into breaking open the movie and talking about what it means, we bring in other texts that are sort of related and try to, like, you know, build our own understandings and build your understanding of what the film is trying to do by looking at, you know, the films that sort of remind us of it. Obviously, this week we're talking about a film that does get talked about in film studies courses, but our job remains the same. And we've got little classes for you now.
Do you can prepare with the syllabus?
I do. I don't know what the name of this class is yet. I think this is a full class and not a module. That remains to be seen, and we might have to revisit this, these movies or this syllabus at some point. But I'm interested in sort of an exploration of patriarchal violence on cinema, on film. Sort of films that are concerned with, and Dustin, you talked about this, I think, God, was it when we, at some point in this marathon, you did sort of talk about Lynch's preoccupation with the violence that men do to women.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that made it onto mic or that was a conversation we were having off mic. But it's all bleeding together because mm-hmm. we've been talking about Lynch together a lot the last 4 weeks or so. But you kind of mentioned this as a preoccupation with his work. And I think, and maybe it was on Wild at Heart where we talked about it. I do want to say that made it onto mic.
Yeah, because
it probably wasn't the straight story.
It's probably in reference to something out of Twin Peaks, I'm sure.
Yeah, but I think a really great starting place for this this film is one of my starting points for it, which is a Maggie Mayfish video essay over on YouTube. The bulk of the essay is about The Shining and Kubrick and Duvall and The Shining and sort of being nice to your actors when you're depicting bad things and sort of using Lost Highway and Lynch and Arquette as sort of a counterpoint to an actor who came out of a movie about the violence that men do to women, feeling supported and feeling uplifted as an actor and feeling, you know, like they were treated as a collaborator and that they were taken care of, especially in a film with this much nudity and this many sex scenes. You wanted to hear that the actors like felt like they were in a safe place.
Yeah.
So that's a really good place to start because it kind of talks about The Shining, which is a terrifying film that doesn't really analyze the violence of men do to women. It depicts it, it considers it, but it doesn't really crack it open and try to like internalize it and like come up with an answer. Lost Highway and Mayfish doesn't get into this a ton, and maybe I hope we'll do this a little bit when we get to business time. I think what Lost Highway does is it does actually analyze this.
Yes.
And it does like make us consider the root causes of these things, the human emotions that lead to these larger societal structures of violence. But what are the films we would pair with it? What are films that kind of like fit in here nicely? I think I don't want to watch all of it or maybe even any of it, but I want to talk about True Detective. I think all four seasons. I think the discourse around season four is interesting with it being the more female-centered season. But again, you know, Nick Pizzolatto's got quotes about season four. The internet has opinions about season four. You know, whatever. The show is a mixed bag overall, but I think it's interesting for our purposes, especially because of that first season sort of really bringing back our conversations around the Dead Girl TV show and sort of these shows centered on deceased women and sort of their bodies as objects. Blue Velvet and Vertigo, I think, as a unit, inform Lost Highway. I think they're kind of like, what if Vertigo, it was Blue Velvet? That's Lost Highway in some ways. So I think that that's going to be useful for our purposes, talking about those two together. I want to talk about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. Mm-hmm. Go with me on this journey. Marilyn Manson gets a bunch of young women to murder a young woman and her lover.
Charles Manson.
What did I say? Marilyn Manson.
Marilyn.
Well, he's a bad guy, too. Charles Manson. Sorry, I was thinking about Marilyn. Charles starts a cult, gets young women to do a murder for him, and a guy. What Quentin Tarantino's presupposes is, what if a bunch of guys killed those young girls before they killed a young girl? I don't know. I don't know what that means, but we're going to talk about it in this class and figure it the fuck out because it's confusing and interesting and worth our examination. We'll talk about Carol Clover's Men, Women, and Chainsaws, a sort of horror film writ large, slasher films writ large, how those inform Lost Highway and I think make Lost Highway a more interesting text. Because we're going to talk about True Detective Season 4 a little bit, we'll talk about Killers of the Flower Moon, talk about murdered and missing Indigenous women, sort of how colonial structures and patriarchal structures kind of support and uplift each other and the violence that they do. We'll talk about Barbie and we'll talk about how, you know, I think we're all more interested as men in the patriarchy when we think it's about Godfather and horses, you know, I think that's when we're most interested in it is as little boys. When we think horses and Macho Man Randy Savage or what it means to be a man. I know I was more interested in it at that point, but I think Barbie will be useful to our purposes here.
Probably.
Last but certainly not least, I'm going to make my class, you know, for years on this show, The Nightingale has been our go-to for films that make you feel bad. Mm-hmm. Well, we're retiring that one for now. And I'm going to be talking about Soft and Quiet from 2022. Beth, oh, I forget her last name. I'll get that filmmaker's name real quick. But Soft and Quiet's a movie about the first meeting of Daughters of Aryan Unity. And a one-take film. Well, kind of a one-take film, you know, disguised cuts film, where you go on that meeting and go on a prank after the meeting and watch that prank descend into kidnapping and murder. And it's a horrible time at the movies. But it is interesting to look at an example of women perpetuating and upholding the violence of male society and structures. I think will be useful for the class. I don't think it will make me very popular. But you know what? Sometimes you got to make people watch movies that are going to make them feel itchy.
You got to walk home.
Sorry. Ooh, I gotta walk home? You're not giving me a ride home? I got to walk home from UConn? Son of
a... Making nobody like you. No, I think it's a great syllabus, man. That sounds fantastic.
So that's the class. Arthur, I'm very interested in your syllabus. I kind of know what direction you're going already.
Yeah, so I don't know how I would do this. If it'd be a module in like an auteurs class, or if it would just be a class on these two directors somehow together. I don't know, because I couldn't get away with that at my current job. But I want to talk about the Hitchcock blonde and the Lynch brunette.
Yeah.
In conversation with one another, because as Dalton has already alluded, I think not only the violence against women, but also just that kind of relationship of that in Hollywood mm-hmm. as well, in specific. And then that's what we're seeing here, especially kind of basing this out of the OJ stuff that Lynch does. In the 90s and looking at those ideas.
Yeah, I remember in my research seeing that that was an inspiration for Lynch and his co-writer on this, the guy that wrote Wild at Heart.
Yeah, Frank Gifford.
Gifford, thank you. Yep.
Kathy Lee's husband, right?
Barry Gifford.
Barry Gifford.
Barry Gifford.
It is a B.
Yeah, sorry.
That's a very funny joke, Arthur.
Yeah, well done.
But that was both surprising and like, kind of a key that unlocks the movie in some ways.
And so I want to think about those ideas. And to do that, I think not only just the Hollywood blonde, which is, I mean, the female blonde bombshell has long been sort of the idea of the Hollywood starlet, mm-hmm. A-list movie star. And so I think that gets formalized very much so within the filmography of Alfred Hitchcock. And so we're going to take a little look back at his filmography and some of the blondes he works with. And we'll start while he's still in Britain with Madeline Carroll, who he does works with on the 39 Steps and Secret Agent before he comes to America. He's going to work with Ingrid Bergman a few times. And Ingrid, I don't know. I mean, she's blonde-ish, but she's not like the true Hollywood blonde.
She's not that ice blonde.
Yeah. But he does three movies with her, Spellbound, Notorious, and Under Capricorn. And then we get to the blonde in Grace Kelly, mm-hmm. Who he works with on Dial In for Murder and To Catch a Thief, and maybe most notably visually sort of idealizing her in Rear Window.
Oh, there's that slow motion kiss on which she's just so zhuzhed up. Yeah.
Well, even when she first shows up in the apartment. Yeah. Right? I mean, she is a movie star, and she goes on to be a Duchess?
Princess.
Princess. Monica. There we go.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
I did the thing. I recalled history. and Grace Kelly is seemingly everything Hitchcock wants out of a blonde leading female talent. In probably all the right and wrong ways, from what we kind of understand, I think, about Hitchcock behind the scenes as mm-hmm. well. And it's something he's going to continue to kind of chase after he loses Grace Kelly. And so we're going to talk about Vertigo. I think maybe the text here of Kim Novak being remade in this image, right?
Yeah, I didn't want to hang on it.
Jimmy Stewart.
I didn't want to hang on it too long because I figured you were also going to talk about Vertigo.
Yeah. And really, I think that underscores both Lost Highway and what we would see in something like Mulholland Drive as well. I think kind of those three films in conversation with one another have a lot going on. Stewart's behavior on screen directing Kim Novak's character to remake her over in this new image of this old flame. Sort of echoing, I think, oftentimes Hitchcock's maybe own behavior behind the scenes as director as well, notoriously a problematic director with his leading women. We'll go to North by Northwest and we'll take a look at Eva Marie Saint, who he works with once. We'll go to Psycho, speaking of violence against women, and talk about Janet Leigh. And again, hear the blonde dying and a brunette herself showing up a little later mm-hmm, in the movie mm-hmm. Without all of the sex and pizzazz of Marion. And then we're going to go to his last blonde that he works with collaborative multiple times in Tippi Hedren, who he works with for the first time on Birds. Notoriously, they're doing the Kubrick thing and torturing her while filming before they go and they do Marnie together as well.
I saw a great TikTok the other day that was like, if you want to know why Dakota Johnson's like that, remind yourself that her grandmother's Tippi Hedren.
Huh.
Yeah. And Dakota Johnson would have heard, grown up hearing stories like, they tied birds to me, Dakota. They tied birds to my arms.
Yeah.
Oof.
And that doesn't even get into, you know, her and Melanie making that movie with that Roar movie. Oh, I forget her husband's name.
Yeah.
That
Cuckoo Banana Pants.
Yeah, what a wild experiment.
And then we're going to move over to Lynch and start talking about him because oftentimes we do have a Hollywood blonde. Who is somehow underscored by this brunette foil in some form or fashion. And we go to Blue Velvet. We can talk about Laura Dern here as the sort of schoolgirl, idealized blonde female who is undercut by the somewhat film fatale of Isabel Rossellini. Mm-hmm. There is the brunette who is the sort of darker, dangerous, forbidden fruit that Kyle MacLachlan goes after. We talk about Wild at Heart again with Laura Dern here, this collaboration that lists at least two more times, right? With The Return and Inland Empire. And then, again, Rossellini showing up as this sort of twisted vision of beauty in this weird made-up wig on. We talked quite a bit about her appearance in that movie and the way she's made up in contrast to someone like Laura Dern there. We talked about Twin Peaks because while it all focuses on or orbits around the death of the proto blonde homecoming queen, it is all of the brunettes who make up the cast and who don't have the same sort of tragic affair or tragic life, I should say, of
Laura Palmer. Yeah, they have pretty tragic affairs, don't they?
There are those. But we have Sally and Nancy, Maddie, who does, I guess, have her own unfortunate run towards the end of that second season. But all these brunette characters, oh my gosh.
Audrey?
Audrey, thank you. Audrey Horne as well, maybe being the sort of proto, almost Betty Page type.
Shelley and Norma. I think Sandy and Nancy or something.
So, yeah, whatever. Yeah. They all have 50s names and nobody cares. You can't keep them straight.
That's fair.
Neither can the guys in town.
True.
So we'd be talking about that and the way in which Lynch often at times introduces a very much sort of Hollywood blonde only for this sort of violent act or tragedy to take place. And all of the sorts of brunettes who circulate rather either as girls next door or femme fatale or both. And the way in which this sort of echoes, I think, Hollywood's traditional relationship with the blonde proto archetype and the sort of brunettes that don't get the same sort of play.
I'm really now, we'll talk about it more in a second, but thinking about the fate of blonde Patricia Arquette in this film of Alice. Once Renee becomes Alice and sort of what the film does there, we'll circle back to that. Dustin.
Yes.
I'm sure it would fill you with nothing but joy to teach this film.
It would.
To a rapt audience.
I probably wouldn't.
No, yeah.
But
it's a tough one.
If I were to find a way to put it somewhere in the sort of appendix auxiliary parts of a syllabus, I think I'd stick it in a screenwriting course, and I would do a module on time loops.
Interesting.
Because there's a time loop bit to this movie. Again, it's a thematic spoiler, but not a plot spoiler for that. And just sort of thinking about the various kinds of this, and a Mobius strip we've already mentioned is the form of this movie. And so I think that's one of those types. Another one of those movies that does something like that is La Jetée from Chris Marker. And so we'd have a look at that. And perhaps also Terry Gilliam's feature length crack at it with 12 Monkeys, which would be a wild time to suggest that. I think also the video game repeat sort of movie is another version of this. You can look at Groundhog Day as an example of this, but also Live, Die, Repeat, which is sort of the obvious example, and probably a movie called Run, Lola, Run from Tickver from Germany, I think would be a lot of fun to look at for that. And then finally, the sort of just time travel in general kind of looping kind of film. And of course, in this case, Looper seems to be an obvious choice there, but also maybe Primer from Carruth. I know we don't love him, but it's a fun movie. And it's a movie that really it makes you have to draw diagrams with your straws, as Bruce Willis says in Looper. And I think that's kind of fun. And just sort of thinking about how they puzzle box those things together and thinking about ways that are successful and perhaps less successful in writing the stories for these kinds of movies. So I think that is a possible approach to a film like this in a film studies course. So there you go, dear listener. Your syllabus just got much longer. I believe now it's time to get down to business. It's business. It's business time. I know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time. Ooh, it's business. It's business time. Okay, I know we have a lot of business to get to, but how goaded is it that Bruce Willis is in two of the best time travel movies ever? 12 Monkeys and Looper. Pretty powerful move, if you ask me.
That's one opinion.
Ooh. Yeah. Ooh, we don't have time to get into that, unfortunately.
One of the
how dare you
most mediocre
Bruce.
Time travel movies of all time, and one very okay time travel movie of all time.
Yeah, Looper being the mediocre one.
No, 12 Monkeys being the bad one.
Wow.
We had that conversation
That's
a long
right,
time ago.
We did. Yeah. 12 Monkeys is good.
You can hear all actually. Of my thoughts on that and Shane Carruth if you want.
I know we've got that on file.
Have at it, internet.
I know Dustin doesn't love Looper. I knew that would be maybe a controversial thing to say.
Yeah, Looper's fine.
Looper, I forgot Looper's you don't very, like very 12 okay. Monkeys.
Yeah. I don't like Terry Gilliam is really what it comes down to, I think.
I like some of it.
That's fair.
Anyway,
he's not as good as he thinks he is.
Are we aware of the real life event inspiration that was sort of sublimating somewhere in the back of David Lynch's and...
That Robert Blake killed somebody?
No, he hadn't done it yet. And he may not have killed the person. I mean...
No, Beretta did that shit.
We are not going to legislate or
that's from a Chappelle show sketch. I can't believe it. Wow, me referencing Chappelle in 2024. I gotta commit seppuku now, I guess.
Yeah, it seems that that's the only choice.
Other than the OJ trial, which
the OJ trial, it is the OJ.
Oh yeah, Arthur referenced that already. Okay. I thought you were talking about something else.
Yeah, if you'd listened to me.
Well,
yeah.
I missed it. I was thinking
of talking about Shane Carruth. Yeah, probably where you were at.
I think the OJ Simpson trial is an interesting sort of place to begin this discussion of violence and women, because there is this kind of story. I mean, and obviously the O.J. Simpson trial is very much tied up with questions of systemic racism as well in North America.
I mean, we got time for this. We got 10 hours of O.J. Made in America for you to watch if you want to learn about that.
We're not. So I
that's
mean,
very important for you to know about.
And
listener.
The People versus O.J. if you want the dumbed down version of it.
But there is also this idea of incredible sort of raging, possessive jealousy.
Yes.
That's sort of at the root of that particular incident. And I'm of the opinion he did it.
So you'll say it for OJ, but not Robert Blake. This fucking guy.
Dude, I've
now who's the systemic racist?
I think OJ should have been found not guilty.
Hey, you know, two things can be true.
And I think he did it.
Two things can be true.
Yeah.
That's kind of what OJ Made in America says too, which I've kind of I have a hard time disagreeing with it.
I'm not convinced Robert Blake did it.
Gotcha.
Is all.
It is very interesting. I know we've already talked about this, but the sort of multiple crimes and criminals related to this film.
Yes.
Including Robert Blake and Marilyn Manson and the
Lou Epicito Epicito.
Yeah. Just sort of.
Richard Pryor.
Yeah.
Richard Pryor.
And Balthazar Getty's father. I mean, that his dad got his damn ear cut off and mailed to a newspaper.
That's wild.
That is wild.
Yeah. Crazy. And then, you know.
And then he's played by Christopher Plummer?
His grandfather's played by Christopher Plummer. Okay. So he's like his great, I guess it would be Balthazar Getty's great grandfather, if my math is right.
I don't know.
You know, John Paul Getty III, like, because his grandfather wouldn't pay his ransom, like, had a stroke over like a terrible addiction problems and ended up having a stroke and crazy. Just pay the ransom. And that movie kind of asks similar questions. Like don't let the violence happen.
Right.
Just choose something else. Choose anything else, please. And that's what the film does. The film says Alice gets to walk out of this movie unharmed. Mm-hmm. I guess
because she's a fantasy anyway.
Sure.
Right.
True. But I guess the movie I think is also trying to, I don't know, give some, she cannot be possessed.
Right.
The way that these men want to, or as this man, Fred/Pete.
Yeah, and Pete is Fred, and Pete is trying to possess her in similar ways that Fred was before, right?
he's just imagining himself in sort of a more classical, helpless young man swept up in a noir.
And of course it's a fantasy because every woman wants to, you know, jump his bones and, right.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. That is what that is. Pete
Cobb gets a line in the guy movie. Yeah.
Gets more ass than a toilet seat. That's a great line. I hadn't heard that one in a long time. I don't know if that comes from this movie, but I've definitely heard that one before.
I've heard it before as well.
But yeah, I know there's something interesting about Alice as ethereal phantom, you know, this sort of maybe not avenging angel version of Renee, but at least this version of Renee that gets to go out on her own terms. Mm-hmm. And again, like, regardless of what Fred does to Renee, he can't possess her. And that is the ultimate, you know, small comfort, obviously, when violence happens. But, like, that violence doesn't define a person. Mm-hmm. That act of violence does not mean that, you know, they don't become their servant in the afterlife or whatever weird Viking shit you want to believe. Like,
no,
that person has been freed of this mortal coil. And as horrible as that is, like, the perpetrator of the violent act does not get to define that person's life. Mm-hmm. And I guess maybe that's what comfort
I think
Lost
so.
Highway gives us with Alice saying, yeah, you can never have me. Do we even want to try to, like, if we have a brave listener who's like, I want to hear them break open Lost Highway without watching it. Do we even want to try to, like, bare bones explain what happens real quick?
Go ahead.
So, Bill Pullman's a saxophonist, jazz saxophonist called Fred. He thinks his wife might be cheating on him because they keep getting tapes.
He knows Dick LaRon is dead.
We don't know what that means. Other than he seems to not like Dick LaRon and is troubled by the mention of Dick LaRon or associates of Dick LaRon. But him and his wife, Renee, keep getting VHS tapes mailed to their house that, you know, show
them in
outside of their house, them in their house. Eventually, a tape shows up where Fred has dismembered his wife, and that is what is on the tape. Fred goes to prison, and while waiting to be thrown in the chair, becomes Pete, and Pete's a young auto mechanic.
He wakes up in the prison cell, and he is a different person. He's a different actor. He's somebody else. They're like, we let him go.
He doesn't just wake up that way. He has, like, a werewolf transformation.
Yeah. Well, fair enough.
And Pete's face has to, you know, heal a little bit. That's kind of a cool touch. Is when he becomes a new guy, his head looks like it's, you know, growing back into shape. So they let him go because he's a different guy.
Do you have any idea how much this stings?
So yeah, Fred puts on his Pete suit.
He's played by Tony Shalhoub.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Fred puts on his Pete suit, goes and hangs out with his friends.
Pete, it's like your skin's hanging on. He's wearing Pete.
Works at the garage.
I didn't know this movie was Men in Black. Now we know.
Works at a garage owned by Richard Pryor. Eventually a gangster shows up and he has a scary encounter with this gangster who's not named Dick LaRon.
No.
Mr. Eddie.
Eventually, Mr. Eddie comes back to the garage with his mistress, Alice, who looks an awful lot like Renee with blonde hair. Alice wants Pete to take her away from all of this. You know, they end up in a torrid love affair. I skipped that part. A torrid love affair ensues. Alice says, take me away from all of this. Here's the mark. Take this mark's money. In this process, we learn that Mr. Eddie is Dick LaRon. Dick LaRon is Mr. Eddie. There's a lot of doubles in this movie. I can't really remember when that information is given.
It's not revealed until
too early?
He turns back into Fred.
Oh, yeah, I guess that's right. Okay, so I skipped ahead a little bit. Anyway, Pete gets a guy killed, tries to blame Alice and say, we got a guy killed. And Alice is like, no, you got a guy killed.
Yeah.
Alice takes the guy's shit and they flee into the desert. They bone one last time. And then the aforementioned Alice saying, you'll never have me happens. And that's it. Patricia Arquette, Renee/Alice, disappears from the film, never to be seen again except in photograph. And then Pete turns back into Fred and sees Robert Blake again. Robert Blake has been haunting Fred/Pete as a little ghoul man this whole movie.
I'm in your house. Me.
You invited me
sometimes
in.
Sometimes my face is on your wife's face, which is very, very
you
upsetting.
You invited me into your life with your nasty little thoughts. That's what Robert Blake is to me. He's sort of a little imp.
Yeah, he is.
He's a murder imp.
He's a little murder imp. Yeah. Robert Blake, murder imp.
Hard imitating life, baby.
So anyway, the murder imp Robert Blake appears to Fred one more time. Fred goes and kills Mr. Eddie slash Dick Laurent and then goes to his own house and says Dick Laurent is dead, starting the film or ending the film where it started.
Going back to the start.
And then he's running from the cops, OJ style. And that's the end of the movie.
The start of the movie isn't the start of the movie because they're already after him because they're after Pete. So there is like this weird overbleed, right? That goes on there. But yeah. Yes.
Time loop. We time loop by the end of the film. And if you're confused, good. You should be.
Yeah, you should be.
You should be. That's why
confusion is great. Well, you know what you said?
No, confusion bad, mystery good.
And if you watch the film, you'll be less confused. I think that's sort of the rub here.
I think you're giving audiences too much credit.
I think they will understand. I think people who listen to our show and have not watched Lost Highway will get Lost Highway when they watch it, is my argument.
Now, I doubt they get it from our explanation.
I think that's my point, though. Explaining this movie is confusing. Watching this movie is not. And that is sort of the magic trick of this film, in my opinion. Like, it is a weird movie to try and explain to somebody, but the film manages it, like, pretty deftly, I think.
I want to sort of switch gears a little bit and just talk about what Fred's problem is. He obviously jealous.
Well, he enjoys nothing.
And yeah, enjoys nothing.
Doesn't enjoy having sex with his wife. Doesn't enjoy playing saxophone.
So I've read some essays that have suggested that Fred is impotent, but I don't get that.
I don't get that either.
I think he's unable to please her.
Yeah.
Is what I thought. And because obviously she's finding pleasure elsewhere.
Yeah.
It seems to be the thing, right?
Well, I read that he's underperforming.
Yeah.
Early performing.
Yeah.
Yeah, or not able to perform.
Yeah.
Is how I read it.
I read it the same way you read it, Dustin. Not that there is a... The performance is very quick. Not that there is a performance happening issue.
It happens to lots of guys, what she says. It
happens to all of us.
Yeah. Seems to be the suggestion, right?
That's sort of the gist of it. And it seems to be more about his insecurities, his fears, than anything that Renee is actually doing.
Right. It's not her fault. It's his fault.
Yeah. The closest we get to having inference of infidelity is that one guy's party they're at is like a little handsy, but not even really. I mean,
he's
pretty chummy. Yeah. Overly familiar.
She clearly knows and is concerned about Dick Laurent when he says, "I heard that he was dead." You know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true. That's
and
true.
So the later reveal.
Yeah.
Indicates, I think, that was a real thing.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, I think.
Well, who cares, though, right?
Yeah.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. The point is...
It doesn't matter, yeah.
Fred, all that matters is Robert Blake shows up in Kabuki
makeup. Dude, that first scene at the party with him is so scary.
It is. It's frightening.
Call me. I'm at your house. I don't know why I'm doing Nicholson, but I can't do an impression of Robert Blake in this movie. It is... incredible because it's way down here when it needs to be and it's way up here when it needs to be and never is there a miscalibration
with two me
exactly because it's like two different energies and he navigates it perfectly and I don't know, is that a good read? What do you guys think of that's my read of Blake, is he's not a real character.
No, I agree.
Yeah. I assume he's some sort of demon angel thing.
Yeah. He's like sort of that Lynch thing you get sometimes of like evil as a specter.
Well, it's sort of like he appears and disappears.
He's from the Black Lodge.
At the murder of Dick Laurent
ethereal.
At the end / beginning of the movie. He's there and then he's not, because I think he's just sort of that which
lies within the heart of Fred.
The manifestation of his own desire to do terrible things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. That was my read as well. And I think it rocks. Cool. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just have a specter that represents like collective evil. Why not?
Yeah.
That's sick. Both halves of this movie are really good. I kind of like the vibe of the first half better, but I think the second half is more interesting.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Does that make sense? Like the first half with the tapes and Pullman is got like a really sort of immaculate, oppressive feeling to it. Mm-hmm. I don't know quite how
that
to articulate it.
Floating Lynch camera.
Yeah. It's very haunting. And yet I'm not like really pulled in by the story. I'm sort of like, okay. Perfunctorily.
There's
like,
something weird going on.
Yeah, I can't
figure out. And she's dead.
And then I'm Pete. We're Pete.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we as the audience have become Fred and Pete, and we're seeing this movie through new eyes. And for whatever reason, it really clicked, even though, like, I think it takes a second for the vibe to get there again. There is, because the prison stuff doesn't really work for me. I love seeing, you're so right, this movie needs more Gary Busey. We were texting about this. Like, we get, like, one Busey moment, Give me more Busey.
Yes.
Supportive biker dad, Gary Busey.
I love that.
What a good mode for him.
Yeah.
I don't know his co-star who's playing the Pete's mother. Mom.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know.
But anyway, supportive biker parents. Great. Sure. Mm-hmm. But it takes a while for the movie to kind of find this weird, like, Gen X neo-noir, goth noir lane again,
mm-hmm.
Which is when I think it's having the most fun in some ways. But there's something like very... Once you get into the Pete half of the movie, there is sort of a change that takes place.
I have a question.
Yeah.
Do you, in Mulholland Drive, mm-hmm. do you prefer... Okay, I got to remember the Naomi Watts character names.
Oh, I won't.
Betty and...
Betty is the imaginary one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then she's Diane.
That sounds right.
In real life, right?
Yes.
Do you prefer the Betty story to the Diane story?
I like the Diane story better.
Oh,
I
really?
Think. The second half of Mulholland Drive.
Like the real skeezy.
Yeah, the real fucking skeezy. No, the color's washed out. Yeah, life sucks. Yeah.
So you like the opposite on that one. Okay.
Exactly. I'm sort of the opposite mind. And it's been so long since I've seen Mulholland now. But yeah, that was when we watched together, however many years ago that was. That was my feeling, was as soon as the movie became another movie, it unlocked, and I was immediately on board.
Mm-hmm.
With this, when we changed to Pete, I was like, all right, well, I need a break, and I'll watch the rest of this tomorrow.
Yeah.
And as soon as I got back into it, it kind of pulled me back in very quickly, and I was very on board for sort of, once Pete breaks bad, and, you know, sort of those last few scenes before he becomes Fred again, I was sort of like, oh, okay, we're kind of back in the groove of the first half of the movie now.
Gotcha.
And I think that maybe that's why I'm definitely like things about the Pete sequence. His ride with Mr. Eddie is very, very intense and very interesting. I think the stuff with Alice is very, very sexy, really kind of like unmoors you because you're invested in this relationship because Getty and Arquette have physical chemistry. So you're like, oh,
you
okay,
don't
this is
like
erotic.
Mr. Eddie. Like, yeah.
You hate Mr. Eddie. You don't want to see keep hanging out with that guy. So you're kind of back in and like it pulls you in until it totally jumps ship on you and goes, no. We're still that movie from earlier.
So I wonder if I could approach a thesis from something else, because I think Mulholland Drive does kind of have that similar kind of two-part structure that this movie has.
They're in conversation with each other, for sure.
And in the Lynch Oz documentary, one of the essayists comments about Mulholland Drive, not about Lost Highway,
mm-hmm.
saying that Lynch thinks that we will understand a character better through their fantasies than we will through the events.
I like where you're going with this. Pete being a fantasy that Fred is having of who he is.
And that we might understand Fred better by Pete.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah.
Okay, I like this. Yeah. Because the version of this story where Pete is the protagonist is like a much more conventional noir. Mm-hmm. He is a man done wrong, right? He's a man like tricked into murder by a femme fatale. Who, you know, he simply is just trying to do right by this lady, when in reality he is, you know, this possessive, jealous, sexually frustrated husband who, you know, wants to control his wife. And so much of this movie is like about that masculine desire to control the sexuality of a woman,
mm-hmm.
right? Like whether that is like interpersonal or societal, it is like very much about that. And that people in this film, men in this film, desiring Patricia Arquette either as Renee or as Alice, either one, but desiring her and wanting to possess her and like control who she is, you know, sexual with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's why it is so important that when the film has, when we get a wrap on Patricia Arquette, it is like her very ethereally exiting the movie, and it's, you know, on her own terms.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a way where, I don't want to say Lynch has his cake and eats it too, because I don't think that's fair.
Well, no,
I think that's not fair to the movie.
I think his fantasy escapes him. I think that's the thing, is his fantasy fails him, just like Naomi Watts' fantasy fails her eventually in Mulholland Drive.
Okay.
And so he's in the thick of that fantasy, and then he just is, again, sort of rubbing up against the truth of mm-hmm. you'll never have her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, she is unpossessable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when she does get her exit.
Yeah. Well, and whatever, like, mutual healthy co-possession could have existed, like you have ruined with like this toxicity within
right.
you and like the violence that you've done.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. I'm just like interested in sort of, we take this veer off into this lane of underground pornography.
Yeah.
And it kind of like really hammers in on that. It's sort of like, as much as it is about like Fred and like the sort of the possession of like marriage and sort of that idea, it sort of becomes more about like sort of the societal commodification of sex
right.
for a little bit, and not for very long. And, you know, the most we get of like Mr. Eddie slash Dick Laurent's porn empire is he throws these parties where he shows people these like maybe snuff films, maybe just horror tinged pornos he's shooting. Kind of unclear if
right.
Marilyn Manson on screen in the screens has been murdered or if that's a gag in the film that they're watching.
But I like to think he was murdered.
I do too. I like to think it's an actual snuff film.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's just sort of, and again, that's like a weird digression. That's not even like a real scene. It's mm-hmm. like Pete's fantasy of Alice's flashback. Yeah.
Yeah.
And the film is often doing that to you, of making you unclear, like what you're seeing is what I'm seeing a fantasy someone's having or an imagination of someone else's fantasy. Like it does kind of keep you on your toes, especially towards the end of the film.
Right.
I think the first, you know, first chunk and second chunk are pretty concrete and easy to keep your feet on the ground. It's those last probably 20 minutes where you're like, wait, what? Mm-hmm. Where are we in time and space now? But I think it works. Like, ultimately, I think that unmooring is good because, you know, Fred's on the run from the cops and is like totally up Schitt's Creek, right? Like, he has destroyed his life and his consequences are coming to get him. So that, like, I don't know, I feel like it makes the heat, that feeling of the heat being on is like really well articulated by the film.
Yeah.
You've seen this a lot.
Yes.
How many times do you know?
Oh, I don't know.
Enough to like really have thought about this.
Yeah. One of the things I really like about it is Zizek's observations about the movie. Can I talk about Slavoj Zizek?
Anytime.
You know, we must invoke the Slovenian philosopher whenever we get the chance. That part of what he talks about is the Mobius strip nature of the movie being the result of psychoanalysis, that you don't actually get to deal with the real, with the trauma, but then you understand that you have it by the end. Because the whole thing is that he keeps denying his past. He keeps denying the facts. He doesn't like video cameras because he likes to remember the things the way he likes to remember it. And that's the problem that Fred has. And then through the fantasy itself is the process of being analyzed. And at the end of that, he now knows that he has something to work on. That's all the psychoanalysis can do. And so he sort of talks about the break of this, because in the end, you will never, ever overcome trauma fully, because you will have to internalize it. It's the linguistically, you know, unnameable. That's what trauma fundamentally becomes. And so you've done a murder like this, you will never, there's no getting over
it. There's no being free of it,
but there is at least knowledge that it's there, because that's the way the real tends to lurk and hide and then symptomatize itself within your other behaviors. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yeah. I got
and
you.
So he sort of relates this, like, this is what analysis does, is what this movie shows us.
Love that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that rocks.
Yeah.
What a fun reading of this movie.
Yeah, Zizek is a maniac.
I do like I think I'm more interested in the sort of Mulholland Drive transposed reading. Welcome to Mulholland Live. Sorry.
You come to know the character through their fantasy.
Yeah, I like that read of it a lot.
Yeah, I prefer it as well.
I think they both kind of fit neatly together in some ways too, though.
But I mean, what an interesting approach to life. If we would, obviously there are facts about human beings and people have done terrible things and people have done good things. But if we think about the way we think about ourselves, the way we, if we would view other people as they view their best selves, to understand them, I think that would be a real charitable way to approach life in general, and also very revelatory, you know, because sometimes your best self will also prove various neuroses and narcissisms and, you know, sociopathy and all kinds of other stuff, you know, as well. But to generally, with a person who's not neurotic, to say, you know what, I want to think about them the way they think about themselves. I want to think about how they picture their best self and use that as my angle into understanding this person, instead of just sort of keeping like a laundry list of you did this, you did this, you did this, you did this.
And it's interesting how the film like shows us what Fred is capable of vis-a-vis murdering his wife.
Right.
And then we take this journey with him as he has become Pete.
And so it doesn't deliver him, right?
No.
But it helps us understand him.
Yeah, exactly. Because he can't get away from what he's done. He mm-hmm. does go back to being Fred once we have reached a point of, like, culmination of events. Once he's, you know, reminds himself in some ways that he can't possess this person. He never could possess this person, and he certainly can't now that he's, you know,
murdered her,
taken them from this planet. Yeah. So it is this, I don't know, it's like this weird, it's not that he comes to accept what he's done, really, because he's still on the run by the
right.
end of it, right? He's still running from it. But it is sort of this, it's the, you know, that meeting with the mystery man, Robert Blake, in the cabin is just like so haunting. And then chasing him away with the camera.
And that reverse,
like,
explosion.
No, before, you, yeah. Oh, you hate, oh, the reverse explosion. Holy shit, what an image. That's just cool to look at. Yeah, I could watch that any day of the week, anytime. But yeah, the reverse explosion to, like, arrive at the cabin, one of the most impressionistic sex scenes you've ever seen, into the cabin, into the mystery man's lair, where the mystery man is confronting you with the observation of your behavior.
Right.
It's great. Like, again, it gets into sort of psychoanalysis and, you know, not necessarily therapy speak, because this film fortunately kind of predates therapy speak pervading our culture. But again, this idea of, like, the observation of the deed sort of cementing it,
mm-hmm.
right? There's something sort of profound about the ability to capture what happened. And again, like, Fred's wanting to hide from being observed and being dictated and documented as he really is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, getting chills.
It's good. Yeah. Well, let's go ahead and pull this train or this car, this off the off ramp of this Lost Highway.
Yeah, let's check into the Lost Highway Motel,
no,
shall we?
No.
You don't want to?
No.
You don't want to get a room with me?
No. No.
All right.
So what do you say, Arthur? Tom's shelf or trash?
Dude is dead.
Oh, no.
Well, I think this is a shelfable film. I like it.
All right, very good. What do you say, Dalton?
Right up there, I'm right there with Arthur. An excellent film for me. Lynch's top three.
It vies for my favorite Lynch. It does. So yep. It's definitely a shelfer for me as well. Surprising no one. We are probably entirely wrong in our analysis, and we need to be set straight. Dalton, tell them how.
I mean, there's not even a snowball's chance. There's no way we spend enough time talking about this. This is a very dense text, and we were never going to get to the bottom of it this week. If you think you can get to the bottom of it, send that email to goodtrashgenrecast@gmail.com. What did we miss? What did we get right? What do you think is important about this film? GoodTrashGenreCast@gmail.com for all of that feedback. Anytime you want to get with us. You can also find both this show and the larger network it represents at Good Trash Media at various places online. Instagram is the only one where we're active, really, but it's at Good Trash Media if you want to give us one of those social media follows. You know, more importantly, though, just, you know, subscribe, follow, rate, review, all that bullshit that you hear about every time you listen to a podcast.
It really helps.
Yeah, just do that. That's all you need to do. Do you want to listen to more podcasts? Bully for you. Here's some more you can listen to. The Wheel of Randy with Dan Wade, an excellent show also on the Good Trash Media Network about the music of the incomparable Randy Newman, one of the great American songsters. Dan Wade sits down with a new guest every episode, and they talk about a Randy Newman classic and a Randy Newman cover, and just go through that man's giant discography. You can also check out The Praise Down with Alex Sanchez and Heath Huffman, where they talk about Christian media as two fellows who grew up in the church but are now living a more secular life. They sort of examine Christian media, interview people about their relationship to stuff and faith. Check those out. The Praise Down and The Wheel of Randy. Those are the shows waiting for you on the Good Trash Media Network. Last but certainly not least, if you want to help support us, you can go to patreon.com/GTM. That's patreon.com/GTM to support us financially and find out what's in it for you. Things like picking a movie for us to talk about. There's only two more weeks left in our David Lynch marathon. Two more weeks? One more week. There's only one more week.
I thought two, too.
I also thought we had two left.
A five-week month or something.
This is number four.
This is number four. Wow. Sure is.
Gosh, I can't believe it. Wow. we've been talking about David Lynch for a whole month, and with a bonus week and everything. Well, if we left Lynch out, that's you're desperate for us to cover. Is it Inland Empire? Do you want to make Arthur watch 3 hours of movie? Patreon.com/GTM if you're dying to hear what we got to say about Inland Empire. You can also have us send you a movie. You get to fill out a little survey. Arthurtron 9000 digests it and spits out a Blu-ray recommendation that we mail right to your house. So that's patreon.com/GTM for more info on that business. Arthur.
Before we send it over to him.
Yeah.
I just want to say that Mulholland Drive was episode 100.
Yeah.
And you watched it 10 years ago.
It has been 10 years since I've watched Mulholland. God, yeah, because we got to episode 100.
You haven't watched it again
years.
Since?
No, since we watched it for the show. No, I haven't gotten to it.
I'm very disappointed.
That is crazy.
Well, this Lost Highway finds us right back at the Black Lodge. And it's only apt that this final pick in this marathon of the one David Lynch goes to the biggest Lynch head at the table, Dustin Sells. Dustin, what are we watching next
week?
Man,
I got to tell you guys, this was hard. This really, really, really hard. I know you've both seen Blue Velvet, and it's incredible, and I love that movie. And I know Arthur does not want me to make him watch Inland Empire because it is very, very long. And The Elephant Man is another one of those sort of non-Lynchy Lynch movies that is very, very interesting and very, very compelling for a number of reasons. However, the fanboy in me, who loves all things hot coffee and cherry pie, must go Twin Peaks. And so we're going to watch Fire Walk With Me for the last entry in our David Lynch marathon.
I knew it. And I will not be watching Twin Peaks, the television series.
You could watch The Missing Pieces.
We'll talk about it.
Okay.
We'll decide how much homework I'm going to do in the intervening week.
Fair enough.
I'm so excited to watch what happened to Laura Palmer.
Good news, dear listener, that gum you like is coming back in style. You keep watching, we'll keep talking, and we'll see you all next time.